Kansas City has very few institutions a century and a half old, and the Board of Trade is one of them. But now this symbol of our agricultural roots is moving what's left of its once bustling operation to Chicago. I'm Monroe Dodd, and today on Central Standard, we'll look at what the Board of Trade, which has its last day of trading this Friday, has meant to Kansas City. We'll discuss its impact on our city and region and the implications for shifting operations to Chicago. That, plus a look at the Skills USA competition going on right now, where young aspiring welders, chefs, and programmers compete to prove they're the best in the country. That's coming up after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Monroe Dodd. Kansas City has precious few institutions that have been around a century and a half, and it's about to lose one of them. The Kansas City Board of Trade, which for years has set the price of wheat for farmers and grain elevators, millers and bakers, and eventually for you and me, will close this week and move what's left of its once boisterous operation to Chicago. With us today to talk about this institution's passing from the Kansas City scene is Michael Browdy, former president and CEO from 1984 to 2001, and Frank Stone, president of Kansas City Trading Corporation, who was chairman of the board in 2007. Gentlemen, good morning and welcome to Central Standard.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
Michael, tell us before we go into a bit of the history of the board, why what's happening here? Why is it closing down in Kansas City?
Well, first of all, let me correct one thing you said.
Sure.
Kansas City Board of Trade discovers the price of wheat. It doesn't set it.
Mm-hmm.
The Board of Trade exists for two reasons, to discover price and as a mechanism for risk transfer.
Okay.
Okay, now to your question.
All right, so tell us why it's closing here in Kansas City.
Well, I think it became inevitable when the trading started a massive move from open outcry to electronic trading. When I came to the Board of Trade, there were five exchanges in New York. There were three in Chicago. There was one in Minneapolis and one here. Now there's one in New York and one in Chicago. And that, I think Frank will agree with me, the catalyst has been electronic trading.
Absolutely. The cost of maintaining the platforms for trading is just huge and takes a lot of capital. And that's exactly the reason it's consolidated.
Now, Michael, I was fortunate enough to be taken on a tour of the Board of Trade back in the 1990s by you and some other folks. And the most impressive thing, or perhaps the most noticeable thing of all at the time, this is the 1990s, was that pit where people that looked to those of us who were tyros as if they're all hanging, hollering at each other the whole time. That's what has diminished as electronic trading has grown.
Oh, absolutely. That's diminished here. It's diminished in Chicago. It's diminished in New York. Now, those of us who really took joy in observing that are going to miss it, but as Frank said, it's just progress.
Now, Frank, you are one of those guys in that pit for a while.
Yeah, I started there in 81.
Mm-hmm.
Frank was one of the real good ones.
How did you go about it with the act of all that you were doing? How did it discover that price?
Well, it's a total operation. You've got lots of people, lots of offices, lots of desks there, and customers from all over the world would call and place orders, and those orders would then go to the brokers in the pit who would execute them. And so it was kind of a central clearing place, so to speak, for what people needed to do around the world when it came to hard wheat.
So you were standing there with the capability of buying a bunch of wheat sometime in the future or selling or both?
You would do both. And it would be either for nearby, like today, for instance, would be the July or September contract, or as far out as next new crop, which would be next July. And it just depended on what was going on in the rest of the world and prices high or low, who were more active.
Monroe, you've got to realize that there's only two things that really determine the price of a trade at the Kansas City Board of Trade or at any exchange, and that's supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as Frank indicated, supply and demand's influenced by a lot of things. The typical trader, I think Frank would agree with me, comes in the morning, and he basically looked at two things, export buying overnight, and the weather in the wheat-growing regions of the United States and in Australia and Argentina and China and wherever else they grow wheat.
So a great example of export buying was when the Russians started buying a bunch of American wheat back in the early 70s?
That's the most historic because it was unusual and it was a huge quantity. And it disrupted the market a great deal for a considerable period of time. More often than not, the U.S. has normal customers that buy our wheat because they like our quality for the most part to make bread. And we treat them just like everybody treats their own customers and try to give them the best product we have.
Right. Mm-hmm. Monroe, I'd like to get a plug in for Heather Paxton's book. Mm-hmm. 7 years ago, at the time of the 150th anniversary of the Kansas City Board of Trade, a local woman, Heather Paxton, wrote a wonderful history of the Kansas City Board of Trade. And one of the focal points of that history is the Russian wheat deal. So I would really suggest to your listeners to look up Heather Paxton's book.
Very good. And speaking of history, let's go back. This thing started way back before the Civil War.
Absolutely. And it started out, it was really more of a Chamber of Commerce type organization than a Board of Trade. And then in the late 19th century, it evolved into a commodity exchange. And as hard red winter wheat became such an important crop, it evolved into the Kansas City Board of Trade, a commodity exchange.
I think one thing that people always ask me is about a seat at the exchange. And basically, we're a corporation. We ran ourselves, and a seat was simply one share of stock. And that share of stock or seat allowed you entry onto the trading floor where you could buy and sell wheat. So, and we governed ourselves and ran ourselves forever. And I think, as Mike and I were talking earlier, I think one of the big things is being a private company. We managed it for the benefit in the long run.
We had 192 seats, and just like the price of wheat fluctuates every day, there was a bid and ask price for seats every day.
And it could range into the six figures?
Oh, yes. The seat ultimately sold when it sold to the CME for over $600,000. But during my tenure there, it got as low as about 50 and
back in the 80s, I think there was an extended period of time in the early 80s where almost every membership traded really close to $50,000. At one time, I think we had a low down around $30,000 and then bounced back up to 50 for a long time and then took off predominantly as we started to get into electronic trading.
Michael, you mentioned CME. That's the purchasing organization here?
Yes. The two exchanges that are left are the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the CME in Chicago, which is combination of the two exchanges that used to be there and some other exchanges, and then an exchange in New York. And actually, the CME was the logical buyer because they have most of the other ag contracts.
What makes the price of a seat on the Board of Trade go through these vast fluctuations?
Well, it's just about the same thing that makes any share of stock change. It's the amount of, in the case of the Board of Trade, it was more of how much money you could make with it. In busy times, where there were a lot of orders coming in, brokers in the pit would fill orders, and the more orders, the more money that you could make. Then they'd bid the price of the entry up, and obviously in slower times, they would go back down.
Simply a determination of value. People
it was, said it was the it earning make. Potential, just as Frank said, it was the earning potential of a seat, what a person could make with it.
Now, you've mentioned hard red winter wheat a couple of times, which is a historical support for Kansas and other places around here. Tell us a little bit about hard red winter wheat and its trading.
Well, I'll tell you a little about the wheat, then Frank can tell you about the trading. But hard red winter wheat is the wheat that bread is made out of, whereas other wheats that make cake, macaroni or cake and so forth. And hard red winter wheat, since it is the bread wheat, is the predominant wheat in this country.
Yeah, hard wheat is grown basically west of the Mississippi to make bread and rolls. The wheat grown on east of the Mississippi is soft red winter wheat, and that's more like pretzels and crackers. Hard wheat is judged more in protein content and is probably the most valuable wheat around the world.
And as I recall correctly, it was brought to this country by Mennonites from Asia or something. And it was good out in these parts in Kansas because it could endure the rather severe conditions.
It very similar to where it came from.
So originally, when the Board of Trade got into this thing, it was because of proximity, probably.
Absolutely.
The Kansas City Board
Absolutely.
Of Trade. The Kansas City Board of Trade has had several historic buildings around town. The latest is at 4800 Main. One is still standing at 5th and Delaware, I think.
Well, and also the one on 10th Street. There's three of them still standing.
That's right. There's a very famous one that's not standing that was at 8th and Wyandotte. We'll come back to that in a second. But I remember seeing a picture of the interior of it, and there's men, clerks. They're all men up on, I think, using chalk to write stuff. What a different age.
Well, there were still chalkboards at 48th and Main. In fact, behind the electronic boards, the chalkboards are still there.
I moved here in 81, and I know in the early spring of 81, we still had board markers, which were typically high school or just out of high school kids that were doing the marking. And then that summer, we changed to electronic boards for the first time.
And, Frank, several of those former high school kids that are board markers later became very successful traders at the Kansas City Board of Trade.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. And today we're hearing about the soon-to-close Kansas City Board of Trade. Our guests are Michael Browdy and Frank Stone. So we've talked a little bit about how things worked in the pit. I must admit to when Michael took us on a tour, a group of guys from the newspaper back in the 90s, one of my memories is of all the gum wrappers lying around that pit after all the guys had been shouting and things. So I suppose this was not a low blood pressure sort of thing to work in the pit.
No, I mean, I think it's pretty common. Most of the guys, when it came time to get their physical, tried to do it in the morning instead of going after the close. I know I've got one friend of mine went afterwards and after a particularly busy close and had some issues and decided to go back again. So it at times, it was very exciting. And it was it seemed to either be relatively slow or just all heck breaking loose. But that was the exciting part of it. A lot of money changing hands. A lot of pressure, but it was I would have to say, one of the best group of guys that I've ever been around in business.
Exactly. Monroe, I've said it many times. As a group of people, it's the best bunch of people I've ever known. And I worked with 18 chairmen, and it was just a great experience.
Ask our listeners now, that's pretty interesting things for some pretty interesting people here. What do you think about the closing of the Kansas City Board of Trade, and what questions do you have for our couple of experts here who have long experience in it? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us. Our handle is KCURCST. Now, guys, I mentioned that in the photos I saw of the old Board of Trade, I mean a long time ago down at 8th and Wyandotte, there were all guys standing around, just like in most businesses. Have women entered
yes.
the trading business?
Absolutely.
Too?
We've had women traders and some very successful ones. In fact, I had a young woman that was on my staff who then went into trading and was very successful at it.
Yeah, it certainly wouldn't be common, but it wasn't unusual. And I can recall of three or four women that have traded in the pit successfully.
You know, another thing, Monroe, the exchange and all exchanges are very strictly regulated by the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. And the only reason we could turn down a person, couldn't turn them down because of sex or because of race or because of religion. The only reason we could turn a person down was a bad credit history, a bad criminal history, or some kind of problem with a other exchange. So man, woman, didn't make any difference.
So, Michael, you corrected me earlier and said that the Board of Trade finds the price, meaning finds
discovers
the level people are willing to pay and sell at. Who's the first recipient of that message? Is it the grain elevators? Or?
Well, I don't think there is like a first recipient. I think everybody's doing their normal everyday business. Mm-hmm. Producers or farmers are typically sellers. Millers, bakers would be buyers. Exporters would be both. Same with country elevators. So everybody's out there doing their own thing. And a hedge is basically a substitute purchase or sale for the cash underlying cash commodity. And in the case of a baker, when the price gets to a point where they can make a margin, they will buy some futures. And then at a later date, they'll sell the futures out and buy the actual flour that they need. And the opposite is true with the producer, who prices go up, he knows he can make a decent money for a living, and he might sell the futures, then at a later date decide which elevator or Baker or Miller he wanted to take the wheat to.
Well, sure. the great thing about the price discovery function is that the price is discovered, and the farmer, the elevator operator, the baker, the exporter, everybody finds out that price at exactly the same second.
Now, a futures thing is to say, I'll buy this from you or I'll sell it to you at some point in the future, not today.
Right. And I don't know what the exact number is, but way less than 1% of those actually go to where they take delivery or make delivery. It's basically, like I said, a substitute purchase or sale, and but it's very liquid. It's not like if you need to go sell wheat or buy flour where it takes some time to for your specific circumstances. You can go into the futures market. It's extremely liquid and buy and sell big quantities at any point in time.
So people, if I'm a farmer...
People always ask me, what's hedging? A simple explanation of hedging is doing exactly the opposite in the futures market of what you've done in the cash market. So that if one... A true hedger doesn't want to make money and doesn't want to lose money in the market. He simply wants the futures market to balance his risk in the cash market.
If I'm a farmer out in Kansas, I'm watching the commodities reports every day or every minute now on the computer, and I'm making decisions based on that, or just kind of hoping for the best based on that.
Well, I'd like to say that they're making decisions on that. However, sometimes it seems like they make decisions on a lot of other things. But certainly, these prices are very transparent from the standpoint. Everybody in the world sees the same thing, and it's not an information problem. Now, in this world, everybody's got the same information. The biggest issue is sorting out which information is important and what is not.
You know, Monroe, a lot of farmers aren't directly hedging using a commodities broker, mm-hmm. but they're forward contracting with their elevator, who in turn is laying off those forward contracts in hedges at the Kansas City Board of Trade.
Mm-hmm. So they go; it's their local elevator that's going to pay them.
That's right, but they're in effect using the futures market. They're just using it through an intermediary.
I think we've talked about the Russian wheat deal of the early 70s when Russia bought a lot of stuff. The export-import is a key factor in pricing, and also the weather. Is there something else?
Those are the two big ones.
Yeah, I'd say, and always in the summer, weather is a huge deal.
So international politics, global weather overseas.
Global weather overseas and international politics as it influences import and export activity.
I would say the biggest thing that happened in my career was Chernobyl that caused the markets to be just crazy for a few days, where we had limit moves in both directions. That was because, well, for a lot of things, we didn't know what wheat it contaminated. Russia grows wheat. We didn't know how it affected the production. And also, did we contaminate wheat that was already around the world in places?
Mm-hmm. Floating around the atmosphere was one of the fears when that nuclear plant went up at Chernobyl. If last Wednesday, as I mentioned, the New York Stock Exchange was watching the Fed, what is the indicator that you guys get up and go, I hope, or like, oh, no. Or is it just the news?
I think it's the news in general.
Or a weather catastrophe somewhere in a wheat-growing area.
Yeah. China these days is always a big deal. Last year they bought some corn right before corn started going up. Mm-hmm. Just because of the magnitude of the purchases they can make, they're probably the one country that we watch the most closely.
What you mentioned a limit move. What was that?
Well, back in those days, I think it was 20 or 30 cents. Now it's like 70 cents. That's how much the futures are allowed to move in one day before trading stops. And basically, that's a limit to let everybody catch their breath, calm down, reassess things. And it makes for a more orderly marketplace.
And the stock market, they call them circuit breakers.
Now, to those of us who aren't involved in all of this, it looks like gambling, but you say it's not gambling.
It absolutely is not gambling. Uh-huh. It's like, go back again. We exist for risk transfer and price discovery. Now, if you have hedgers, people who want to shed themselves of risk, you also have to have speculators, people who want to take on risk. Mm-hmm. Speculation is not a dirty word. The Kansas City Board of Trade was not the gambling den on Main Street. The Kansas City Board of Trade provided a very, very valuable economic function.
And tell us, Michael, a little bit historically, what was its function in terms of the city? There were some important people involved, fortunes
made. Well, if you looked at there's a wall outside the offices of the Kansas City Board of Trade that Frank's picture's on there, and the 150 people who were chairman. Well, some of the names on that wall are Kemper, Latshaw, Ullman, some of the biggest family names in this community. So the biggest families in Kansas City were intimately related to the Kansas City Board of Trade.
And
we're
families,
very proud of that.
And those families spent their money here and had projects here.
Absolutely.
And had banks and things.
Absolutely. I always took visitors on that visitor's balcony, and we looked down on that floor, and I said it without hesitation, more money changes hands down there than anywhere else in Kansas City.
Huh. But now that it's departing, are we going to miss it?
I hope so. I'm going to miss it. Aren't you, Frank?
Yeah. It's been part of my life since 1981. It's a big deal. And even though things have changed where we're not using the pit anymore, it's really sad to see your friends that you've known for 20 or 30 years kind of go their separate ways.
Monroe, as I told you earlier, I had three loves in my life, my family, the Missouri Tigers, and the Board of Trade. I'm down to two now.
Kansas City, are you going to miss the Board of Trade? It's a big deal, and it's going away. If you want to call us, join the conversation. The number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And we're here with Michael Browdy and Frank Stone today to talk about the soon-to-depart Kansas City Board of Trade, which has been at 4800 Main Street since the mid-60s.
Correct.
And before that, as we mentioned, it was a 10th and Wyandotte, I think. There was a little bit of talk back when it moved out in the 1960s that this might have been an instigator of some of the flight of businesses from downtown.
Well, let me give you the history of what happened. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there, but the funny part, I was sort of involved because I was working for one of the banks involved. At that time, Bob Ingram was going to build a building at 10th and Main, which he ultimately built. Mm-hmm. They had a deal that it was going to be the Board of Trade building, and that was going to be the cornerstone of the building. What happened was his building was getting money from land clearance for redevelopment. Big Jim Kemper Sr. had built Commerce Tower without any government money. Mm-hmm. He got an injunction to hold up Ingram's building. When that building got held up, Miller Nichols went to some of the people at the Board of Trade and said, hey, let's partner in a building on the plaza. And that's how it ended up on the plaza.
But perhaps it didn't instigate things, but it certainly was one of the organizations that had made downtown a hub of business. And that's why a lot of people are struggling to reinvigorate downtown these days. The advent of computers, all this business that has gone from a shouting bunch of guys in a pit to the computers, this is all in the last how many years?
Probably the last 5 years.
Yeah, it started about 10 years ago, but it really intensified in the last five.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of different places that tried platforms and what have you and kind of sputtered a little bit at first. But then the Mercantile and the Chicago Board of Trade got onto it, and it was kind of gradual at first. But then once it started steam, it really migrated. And a big part of that was, I think, instituted by major funds starting to trade commodity futures. Before that, a lot of these like pension funds and what have you didn't use the futures market. And then it was determined that probably a small portion of their portfolio would be enhanced by trading commodity futures. And that influx of volume was right about the same time as the computer trading.
And Frank, don't you think the advent of the managed futures industry helped too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Where people would buy into a fund, and professional managers would manage it, trading futures.
Just like a mutual fund for stocks. A managed commodities fund is simply a mutual fund, but using commodities rather than stocks.
And what would you date this evolution to, the 2000s, 1990s, the last 5 years?
Well, I mean, I think it started in the early 2000s, but really picked up steam as we got closer to 2010.
That's great.
And I also want to say this pickup in volume not only came from the U.S., it came from all around the world. Money is real liquid and tries to find opportunity any place. And so we had a lot of money coming in from every place around the globe.
And it can do so now because of the Internet revolution.
Well, Kansas City Board of Trade had two Japanese trading firms that were member firms. The Australian Wheat Board was a member of the Kansas City Board of Trade. I mean, we were truly an international organization.
Now, back at the turn of the last century, in the 1900s and the 1910s, 20s, 30s, the traders were mostly in this part of the country or in the United States. And how were they communicating?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was just normal back then. And Kansas City was a hub from both rail and water. We had the Missouri River that was very active during those time periods. Mm-hmm. And so it was more natural to have local type people, certainly in the U.S., but more specifically Kansas, which grows the most wheat of any other state. And then it just progressed along with how commerce did.
Now, we've talked pretty much exclusively here about hard red winter wheat, but the Board of Trade has tried other products and things over time.
Yes.
Also.
In the 80s, the Kansas City Board of Trade introduced the first stock index futures contract in the world with the Value Line contract. And when I came to the Board of Trade in 84, the Value Line contract was going gangbusters. We also, during my tenure there, introduced a Western natural gas contract that for a few years was very successful. Over the years, three or four times, they've tried a sorghum contract. So wheat is not, while wheat has been the mainstay, it hasn't been the only thing. And we, as a matter of fact, Wall Street Week, which at the time was the most popular show on public television, mm-hmm. came out and Rukeyser did his show live from the exchange when the Value Line was prospering.
Yeah, that was the big deal back then before we had 24-hour financial networks.
Absolutely.
And the Value Line basically based the discovered price by the Dow?
No. The Value Line Index, Arnold Bernhardt's company, the Value Line Service, had a very broad-based stock index, and that was the basis for it. When the people in Kansas City dreamed up the idea of a stock index future, they went to Dow Jones, and Dow Jones didn't want to buy.
Huh.
Later, years later, they did allow a contract at the Chicago Board of Trade. They also went to the S&P. The S&P didn't want to. They very quickly, after the Value Line was successful, gave a contract to Chicago. But the Value Line was a broad-based stock index based on the service run by Arnold Bernhardt.
And Frank, did you trade the Value Line also?
Yeah, I did. I mean, during there was a period of 3 or 4 years where I don't recall. I think we had an overabundant supply of wheat, but the wheat market was pretty quiet, and the stock market was just really kind of going crazy at that time. The Value Line was like index of 1,400 stocks, and I remember when we started, it was kind of a big deal who was going to stay in the wheat pit and fill orders and who was going to go over in the Value Line and fill orders. And I was associated with a company that did both, so I traded both places just depending on where there was the most activity. And which for quite a period of time was the Value Line.
Really, a lot of people think that the Value Line, the demise of, can be traced to the stock market crash of 1987. That was part of it. But I always said the biggest reason for the demise of the Value Line was that the wheat market came roaring back, and a lot of those traders that had emigrated over to the Value Line pit came back to where they were most at home, the wheat pit. Wouldn't you agree with that, Frank?
I think there was a lot to that, and because that's when kind of the world population started catching up with the supply, and those markets became way more active. And at the same time, interest in the stock market was really from the public sector lagged a great deal after 87.
So it's a matter of going where the action is.
Exactly.
Like so much of the economy in the world.
Exactly.
I have to mention before you go that that Board of Trade building that was architecturally a fairly important one down at 8th and Wyandotte. I know you guys were gone from that area and on to 10th and Wyandotte by then. But it is a great symbol in Kansas City of the instituting of the preservation movement because it was torn down almost overnight. You've seen pictures of it,
I'm
sure.
Yeah, there's some great pictures of it in Heather's book.
Yeah, that was quite a place for the open floor. And I imagine in those days the trading floor was not air conditioned in the 1910s.
Well, Frank and I are just taking the attitude now that it's better to have loved and lost than never loved at all. Right, Frank?
That's exactly right. It was a great period.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. Michael Browdy, the former president and CEO of the Board of Trade in Kansas City from 1984 to 2000, and Frank Stone of the Kansas City Trading Corporation and who was chairman of the board in 2007. Gentlemen, thank you for this last look as we say goodbye to the Kansas City Board of Trade.
Great to be here, Monroe.
Thanks a lot.